It seems to me that the report, as published in the British Medical Journal in 1948, of streptomycin treatment of pulmonary tuberculosis is remarkably clear. In this, I think I perhaps partly flatter myself, for my memory is that it was drafted by Philip Darcy Hart, his very able and attractive assistant, Mark Daniels, and myself. The wording is, as I have it in front of me, the Special Committee of the Medical Research Council decided that a part of the small supply of streptomycin allocated to it for research purposes will be best employed in a rigorously planned investigation with concurrent controls. Now, it may well have been that that decision was reached without too much discussion and great difficulty. But of course, I think its roots went much further back. In my own situation, I had published my articles in The Lancet, which led to my handbook, Principles of Medical Statistics, just on 10 years earlier, in 1937. In that, I had set out, I think, reasonably clearly, the need for controlled experiments in clinical medicine with groups chosen at random. I think I pleaded that it could be made down on using alternate cases. And I suspect if, and it's a very large if that in fact were done strictly, they would be random. But I deliberately left out the words randomization and random sampling numbers at that time, because I was trying to persuade the doctors to come into controlled trials in a simple way, and I might have scared them off. Randomization and random sampling numbers are a slightly odd concept to the layman, I think, or the lay doctor for that matter, to statistics. And it'd be better to go get him to walk first before I made him run, or try to get him to run. So I had been thinking of it for all those 10 years, hoping for an opportunity that might arise. I had already used random sampling numbers in the less emotive field of the vaccine. The whooping cough vaccine was based upon children randomly put into a whooping cough vaccine or an anti-catarrhal vaccine. But I had not, up to this point, had an opportunity to use them in a clinical situation. Now one arose, and I was therefore completely ready for it. Secondly, I think the MRC had a tuberculosis research unit under the very able direction of Dr. Philip Darcy Hart, a very distinguished physician in tuberculous diseases. He had been frustrated, I think, by some 15 years of playing around with gold without being able to do a controlled trial and find out whether it really was effective or not. And so I think he himself, if something new came along and there was a chance of doing a really good controlled trial, was ready to seize that opportunity. And he could argue from the medical point of view while I was arguing from the statistical. But the third and dominating feature, which perhaps is not sufficiently stressed, was that we were extremely limited in the amount of streptomycin that we had. It had been discovered in America in 1944, It was just after the Second World War that we were trying to make the trial in 1946, and we literally had no currency. We'd exhausted all our supply of dollars in the war, and the Treasury was it's adamant that we could only have a very small amount of it. And this, I think, turned the scales, that I could argue with the chairman, Sir Geoffrey Marshall, a very attractive and good physician, very sensible, and he would listen. I could argue that in this situation, if it had not been immoral to make a trial, it would be immoral not to make a trial. With the opportunity would never arise again, because streptomycin would become synthesized, there would be plenty of it, and so on and so on. At that time we were handicapped. We could only use it, have enough to use on about 50 patients. There were no dearth of patients. So the report, in fact, they laid down so many rules that there did appear to be a bit of a dearth. But if we persisted, there were plenty. And we were therefore limited to this number of about 50. And I thought that was probably enough to get a decent answer, so long as it was strictly controlled. And so it proved. I think there was no doubt that it was the first strictly controlled trial which ushered in the new era of medicine which began after the Second World War. I'm not quite sure what I can add to this, except some personal memories. Such as I've now given, dating back to 37 and with Dorothy Hart, some 15 years. What else can I say about it? I think there's very little, except that dominating feature, the shortage. I wonder, supposing there hadn't been a shortage, would that committee then have been reached that same conclusion? I rather doubt it, but I shall never know. I think they would probably have hedged. Of course, there were no ethical problems in those days. We didn't ask the patient's permission, or anybody's permission. We didn't tell them they were in a trial. We just did it. And to tell the truth, I think a lot of this decision today of informed consent is absolute rubbish. Nowhere, ignorant layman can understand and be told all the possibilities. Supposing you tell him that if you put a needle into him with water in it, he may fall down in an anaphylactic shock, and so on and so on. The doctor has to weigh the pros and cons, really. It rests with him and his morality. But that is my personal opinion. You must realize that at the moment I'm well into my 93rd year, and all this happened my arithmetic's not all that good, 43 years ago. But on the whole, I can remember what happened 43 years ago. I can't remember what happened last week. But that, I think, is characteristic of old age. I hope this is of some interest to your journal, but I rather fear it doesn't add anything. and accept a personal expression of what went on. Yours sincerely, Austin Bradford Hill.